Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to introduce our guest, Chip Rui, the Chief Investment Officer at Rui Asset Management. Chip has over 30 years of value investing experience with leading buy-side financial institutions. He has led many different strategies, ranging from small-cap to large-cap focuses, and concentrated 10 to 20 position strategies. As always, please feel free to post your questions in the live chat throughout the presentation, but keep in mind we're going to hold on to those until we get to the Q&A section at the end. I'll go ahead and hand things over to Chip now, and we'll jump into his presentation.
Thanks a lot, Graham, and thanks to Charlie and everyone at Guru Focus for the opportunity. It's an honor, and I look forward to it. And I do want to leave plenty of time for questions. I'll give a little bit about my background and my philosophy and process, illustrate that through two stock examples, and then go to Q&A. So you know, hopefully this can be educational for anybody and instructional perhaps. And please, just a disclaimer, this is not a solicitation of any sort or a recommendation of any sort of stocks. And one of my mantras is think for yourself. I truly believe that. So, you know, just please use this from educational and informational standpoint. But again, I'm excited to present and tell you what I think of value investing. Little background on me, Graham gave some, and really what I think the takeaway from my career is I've worked for three value gurus, Laura Sloat, Jerry Kramer, and Marty Whitman. And yeah, I think all three of those have shaped my career and led me to where I am now. And I think my strategy is built on the strengths of all three of those. And, you know, dissecting it, you know, Laura Sloat is a great value investor. She's really an inspiration. If you don't know much about her, Google her. She's been blind since 6 years old, but has really built up a firm and a fantastically successful value career. Really what she taught me is not only the blocking and tackling of this business, tearing apart financial statements and due diligence, but really to two major takeaways. One, think about the business as if you were running it. Put yourself in the shoes of the CEO or managers and dissect the company on what's going on. Ask yourself what you do different. And that can be a good basis for asking questions to management. Why would you do this or why wouldn't you do this? You can really understand the business. The second part is to have a vision for a company, not only what they're doing right now, but how that can evolve over 3 to 5 years. Where can profitability go? Where can revenues go? What's the balance sheet going to look like? Can they spin something off? What's the market share going to be? You know, today's income statement is a point in time and it's relied way too heavily on in the investment community. We're interested in the balance sheet and we're interested in looking forward 3 to 5 years. Jerry Kramer, I think, taught, you know, building on that, taught the behavioral aspect of the business to me. We work on these stocks. We live and breathe our due diligence, our research. We talk to the companies. We think we know a lot about them. But at the end of the day, they're stocks and they don't have any emotion towards us. And the great investors don't have any emotion towards them. You know, when it comes time to sell, when it comes time to buy, be dispassionate, cut through the emotion, cut through the investor emotion, the neglect or the overabundance of love for companies and get right down to what it's worth. And I think Jerry Kramer was kind of the best at that in the business. You know, Marty Whitman, probably the most well-known of the group. Everybody knows his focus is balance sheet first. And I think for value investors, that's what matters. Marty focuses on the assets and that's what the assets are worth, not what the balance sheet says they're worth. And that's a great takeaway. You know, they do so all sorts of accounting vagaries and everything else. You know, what are the assets worth and what can they earn? And I think if you, what I've taken away from Marty and built on from Marty is that second point, really, what can the assets earn? Because if you just look at book value, you can get in trouble. You know, one funny anecdote I have is if you just spend $1,000 on a brand new stagecoach, the day the railroad comes to town, that $1,000 isn't worth a lot, although it's marked at $1,000 on the balance sheet. So, you know, it's really what you can earn on the asset and really why I focus on return on invested capital. And you know, just dragging that down or distilling that down to what I think the competitive advantage is that I pursue here is moving those three points of view into one strategy. Focusing, as I say, on long-term capital appreciation and downside protection. That is, downside protection protects you over your period of 3 to 5 years. Live to fight another day and, you know, get through periods like COVID without being forced to sell and have conviction to buy more when you have the chance. You know, I strongly believe, and this is really a differentiation point of myself, that value is not the antonym of growth. I won't own the equity of a company that can't grow over time. And I think that's an important notion that value investors get hung up on sometime, or growth investors, when they think of value, they don't think growth. You're really buying undervaluation and you're buying the ability to post high return on invested capital. That's what it is. We're not interested in buying cigar butts at cigarette butt prices. That's what, you know, Warren Buffett says, but really focusing on the ability to grow and earn over time. And I think if you focus on that aspect of what the assets can earn and what you can put up as far as ROIC, it helps you avoid value traps and avoid liquidating scenarios where the value might melt a lot quicker than you think. Where I focus now at Rui Asset Management is small caps, and I'll get a little bit more into why I think there are over 4,600 choices versus if you look at large caps, there's, you know, depending on what you're looking at, maybe 300 companies. So there's a lot more room to do effective due diligence, potentially to gain an edge through research and hard work, and to create a competitive advantage that an ETF can't arbitrage away. And if you own 15 to 25 names at the bottom, you don't own the market. Again, you know, we're not interested in committing capital for market exposure. We're interested in return on invested capital, just like our companies are. Cutting to our philosophy, everybody's got three pillars. My pillars are downside protection. I talked about that. The ability to grow in valuation. Downside protection starts with the balance sheet. It lets you live through rocky times, and there will always be rocky times in the stock market. Things don't go in a straight line, and there are always periods of over hype and over neglect. The ability to grow, I touched on, and of course, valuation. You know, it's what you pay for. And as Jerry Cramer would say, you want return on capital, not return of capital. So you, there are a lot of great companies out there where the valuation doesn't make any sense in our book. So distilling that down and just hitting on that a little bit more, downside protection in the middle. I seek to identify companies with low debt, and again, with any contingent or off balance sheet liabilities, any environmental liabilities, any litigation worries, anything that can drain cash out of a company that can impact your financial position or force, in a worst case scenario, company that might have to raise financing, debt or equity in a downturn. You know, it's detrimental to your value as an equity investor. It's also detrimental to the strategy of a company to have the management team focused on raising capital or managing cash versus spending their time on how to grow the business and expand the business. So a weak balance sheet just sends a cascade of negative ramifications through a company. And that's kind of the first step. The ability to grow, I touched on, again, you know, we want to have high ROIC for at least our 3 to 5 year investment horizon. That's where, you know, kind of Laura Sloat's vision comes into view. You know, what can we do? What are you earning today? Where can these revenues go? Where can the margins go? Where can profitability go? You know, can the market grow? Can your market share grow? What are your competitors doing? There's lots of things there, but you've got to think forward and make sure your company is doing the right things, has the balance sheet to invest where needed, and is competitive with their offerings today, and can those assets continue to earn a competitive cost of capital looking forward? Again, what they're earning today is no guarantee of what they can earn 2 or 3 years from now. And again, anything that just looks cheap or is in liquidation, you know, or it could be a value trap. So I seek to avoid those. And then valuation, I'm a patient investor, and I'll touch on that a little bit more. But again, you know, a minimum discount to what I think is fair value. And my definition of fair value is where I think it should be trading today, not what it's worth in the future. In this market, I think there are opportunities where you can get much more than that, just given the volatility and some of the damage that's been done to smaller caps. Where I get ideas in the universe, I can get ideas from, and this is again why small cap and mid cap is just a more fertile hunting ground than larger cap. First of all, there's more names. So if you've got an ETF in the large cap area, you can encompass more of those names, and you know there's a lot less potential for competitive advantage. But down cap, my primary benchmark is the Russell 2500 value. That's small mid. The Russell 2000 value is small. I kind of look at both of those. But if I look at companies with between 100 million and 10 billion in market cap, it's about 4,600 companies in the US. Not all those are covered by Wall Street analysts. A lot of those are unknown. And that's where, you know, hard work and due diligence come into play and identify competitive advantage. And, you know, you can see in the middle here, two main ways, not a secret, qualitative. And I basically say that's connecting the dots, looking at a 10K, a 10Q, press releases, conference calls, you know, get on the website of these companies, listen to their conference calls, look at their presentation. So lots of information there. And start asking yourself these questions on how would I manage the business? You know, a lot of times you can get an idea from one company to another. I was up visiting at a helicopter company one time, and they were trying to figure out how to make carbon graphite fit on the outside of helicopters, and they couldn't use fasteners. They had to have glue. The next question, of course, is who makes the glue, and is that company an investment? So really start thinking about the connections and connecting the dots for good original ideas. Quantitative screening, it's everything that you would think about. You know, screens aren't the be-all, the end-all. They're the start, their output is the start of my process. So again, everything that we would have talked about in philosophy, low or no debt, high and improving ROIC, revenue, earnings, book value compounding over 3 to 5 years. I like to look at things that are down on a 1 day, 1 month, 1 year, 3 year basis. The question is, why have they gone down? And are those temporary or permanent reasons? And if they're temporary, how temporary? And has the company got the balance sheet and the management team to fix them and recover? And those can make great value investments. But again, for wherever I get the idea, that's the beginning. And I would not recommend hopping from a screen to your portfolio. There's a large second step of what I call work in process. I'm going to take you through this. It's pretty busy in great detail. But look at the capital structure. So Marty Whitman used to say, look at the capital stack, not just the equity, but the debt. What are the maturities? What's the structure? Is it variable? Is it fixed? What is their cash flow burn? When is the debt due? And, you know, is it due this year? Is it due in 5 years? Is it on a term facility that needs to be refinanced, or is it bonds that are outstanding? You know, those can come into play over a 3 to 5 year horizon. So you need to know where you stand in the capital stack. And as equity investors, we're always at the bottom. So you need to know who's above you and what the calls on repaying that are. A great place to start when you're looking at a new company is not only a 10K business description, but get the annual report and read the CEO letter for the past 1, 2, or 3 years. They're going to tell you what they want to do. And if they told you that in 15 and 16, they haven't done it. In 17, they haven't done it. In 18, they haven't done it. Offers up a good question. Or if they are doing it, they're continuing to do it, offers up a good track record of being able to do it, regardless of what the stock price has done. I do create a financial model for everything that I own. Not so much to beat the sell side. I'm not in competition with the sell side. I do like to understand sensitivities. You know, how do margins hold up? Variable margins, as far as revenues, you know, growing or contracting, you know, and what are the fixed costs? Are the fixed costs scalable, logarithmic, or stepwise? You know, just understanding those sort of things can help you get a better idea of a company. And if you do get a bad quarter or anything like that, having the model there to just run some sensitivities really can help you build conviction and potentially buy in and neglect and take advantage of share weakness, or conversely, be a signal that maybe you ought to move away. Accounting assumptions. You know, one of the examples I'll talk about today, lease expense is really obscuring the balance sheet. You got to dig into how they account for things and what the changes in the accounting regimes are for some of these companies, because they can make the balance sheet look different from year to year. I do have detailed calls with management when I can. Usually you start with the investor relations, but again, if you really take your time and understand these companies and have good calls with the investor relations, they'll usually, you know, let you go up the food chain and speak to, you know, higher people if they understand that you're putting the time into your work on the company. For every company I own too, I make an investment case, and I would recommend everybody does this. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. But put your assertions down, why you own it, what you think it's worth, and what would make you sell it. And that document should live through your holding period. And when there's times of, you know, hitting your price target or potentially going against you from purchase costs, bring that document back out. You know, to what did you originally think and what's changed? That, it's very important. And again, that removes a lot of the emotion. Oh my gosh, it's a great day. I feel wonderful that the stock's up, or I feel terrible that it's down. Remove that emotion, go back to your case, your model, your due diligence, and figure out if you should buy some stock or if you should sell it. This is how I move from a stock that I think is worth investable to how do I fit it into the portfolio. I think it's proprietary, and I'll walk you through this a little bit. I not only establish along the x-axis a price target and potential 3 to 5 year upside, but on the left side, I have a qualitative, and this is purely qualitative, risk weighting. And, you know, I have an A company, which is potentially like a utility or a timber company, you know, just real low risk, steady business, not too much volatility in the model. Conversely, a C could be a petrochemical company, an oil company, you know, C for cyclical, anything where the business can change quickly. If you lay that over upside and downside, or if I lay that over, I should say, I think that helps dictate the position. For example, in the top right corner, if I can find an A company where I can get 50% upside, that should be a maximum position size for me, because it means I'm taking relatively little risk for a lot of return. Conversely, if I think I can get 20, 25% up, maybe just around 30, maybe I'll take a smaller position in that because I'm taking less risk. Or, you know, and then converse that. If I have a cyclical company where things can swing on a dime, you know, every year is different, every year there's many cycles within a year over a number of years, I never want that to be a top position of the portfolio, even if I get 50% upside, because things change quickly and there's not always times to react. But if you see 50% up in a commodity company, that can be a medium or a minimum size position for sure. And then just thinking that through, if it's a D company, why would I ever own a D company? The way I would think, bad management, bad balance sheet, bad market position. There's just no reason to get involved with those. Or if I can make less than 10% on a stock over 3 years, it's overvalued. And again, this is investing. You're buying for return of capital. So, you know, I just really don't have interest in owning even great companies that are overvalued. So hopefully that gives a little thought about portfolio structure. This is also something unique that I try to do when I think about my holdings in a portfolio. I call it a correlation matrix. It's qualitative. It could be called risk buckets. It could be called anything you want. But basically what I'm trying to say is if I look at my portfolio versus if I look at, say, the Russell 2500 value, the 2500 value will have this much in financials and this much in industrials and this much in healthcare. It doesn't tell me anything about how the portfolio really is going to behave, because on the days China matters, my Hillenbrand, my GrafTech, my UltraClean will matter. What I don't have exposure to, REITs, utilities, transportation, energy, that's a big risk for outperforming or underperforming. There's some upside here, companies that I think could be vulnerable to activist actions. Some of it's positive. Where can I get good exposure to housing or 5G and artificial intelligence? This just helps me quantify it. I do have weightings in here. I actually type the percent of what I own just to make sure. This is a subset. I've, you know, of course, just cut it off for demonstration purposes. But it's something that, you know, again, you should think just beyond I have this much in financials or this much in industrials, because that hasn't helped me over my career. Industrials don't behave like other industrials on stress factors. And again, the most important part is when I buy something for myself or for the fund, that's just the beginning of my due diligence. The investment case, as I said, is a living document. You know, you follow the company, you keep asking questions, and you keep learning, and, you know, keep doing your own work. Sell discipline is easy. Price target has been reached. There's a better risk return scenario with something stochastically dominant. Maybe I'll sell a railroad if there's a better railroad and I don't want to own two. And the other part, if an investment case breaks, if I want to own something for A, B, and C, and B and C don't come true, there's no reason to be there. And there's a 4,600 stock universe. So get it out of the portfolio and get something else in. Remove the emotion from it. They're stocks, no matter how hard you've worked on them. There's plenty of others. Again, that's my disclaimer for this presentation. Everything else, my idea is educational, not a solicitation. And again, I'm happy to have the opportunity. So, you know, I thought that's kind of the first part, and maybe I'll just give you a quick, you know, I want to talk about a couple companies, but my market outlook, maybe where we are right now, just to set the table. It's a crazy time and a crazy year. I am still pretty bullish, pleased to see the action of Monday and Tuesday for small cap value, a long time in coming. Small cap value has underperformed large cap growth for a long time, large tech growth and growth for a long time. And a lot of that, I think, has been due to the total collapse of yields in the yield curve, easy money by the Fed. I mean, we've had QE in one way, shape, or form, quantitative easing, since the financial crisis. What that means in my book is if you're an investor, protecting on the downside and focusing on downside risk has not been a factor that's helped you. And in fact, to some extent, ignoring that and only focusing on the upside has been a factor for outperformance. So, and value investors do focus on protection in the downside. We look at the assets. And, you know, that's, you know, one of the reasons, but it's a main reason in my mind. And I think where we are as far as rates and the cycle, I think that rotation is starting. Everything moves in fits and starts, but we'll see it. Breaking that down, the economy's healthy. It was healthy coming into the year. And the important part in my mind of what COVID has done, it's been a supply shock recession. And that's important because there's been strong demand. We haven't had weak demand. We haven't had eroding demand. We haven't had cyclical peaks and imbalances that have to be worked off. This was an economy that was shut down, even though consumers still wanted to consume. We weren't able to. So, you know, if we can open back up, hopefully this economy, in my mind, can get going, especially given the stimulus, especially given the Fed action, especially given the low rates. I mean, that's all gasoline on the fire. And now add in antibody therapies that are being approved and vaccines, which, you know, hopefully, knock on wood, we'll see approved, not just one, but two or three before the end of the year, potentially six within a couple months. Yeah, that can turn everything back on. You know, supply chains have been weak, and demand could come out really strong, and this market could really continue. I think what that means is the thought that interest rates are going to be flat to zero for 3 years. To me, it's an assumption that doesn't make a lot of sense. Go back and look at a yield curve. They've never been flat for 3 years. And if everything comes true the way it's looking like it is, as far as from the healthcare vaccine, antibody side, antiviral side, the economy restarting, and all the stimulus actions that we've had and potentially more combined with low rates, you know, we can have inflation. And Powell says he'll let inflation run hot. So I wouldn't build a 10-year DCF with rates at 25 basis points in a terminal value that uses low rates. And I think maybe some of the growth investors that are doing that are getting a little over their skis. Remember, we have $27 trillion of debt in this country. $27 trillion. And at the end of 2021, it could be closer to 30, depending on the deficit and the size of extra stimulus. The 10 years under one, when I started to prepare for this this weekend, this presentation, I was going to say 75 bips on the 10-year. Now I'm saying 95. What rate would you have to get paid yourself to buy a 10-year treasury now? Just ask yourself that when you think about where rates can be for 2 or 3 years with 27 to 30 trillion in debt. For me, 1% doesn't come close. Which again is why equities from here can be a better alternative for sure. One of the companies I like that I'll just talk about a little bit on how I approach valuation. This is Weyerhaeuser, ticker symbol WY. What I'm looking for, you can find on the web. It's a presentation from their investor relations website. This page I like just because it lays out kind of who they are. They've got 11 million U.S. acres of timberland. It's kind of base assets that grow every year. Money doesn't grow on trees, but maybe it grows in trees in my mind here. Very stable business. They've got a real estate unit that basically sells higher and better use land, things that could be lakefront, waterfront, mountaintop. It's probably part of the Timberlands unit is the way I think of it. And then they have a wood products unit that they've completely restructured, benefits from housing, renovation, markets that are still below 10-year peaks. So, you know, the housing market is still not recovered from the 2005-2006 housing boom, meaning we haven't gone back above trend starts. And I'll show another slide on that. It's not like autos that have gotten back or other industries that have come back. We're structurally still below and still at deficit. So the little housing start that we've seen this year can continue for a while. And I think Weyerhaeuser could be a beneficiary of it. Why do I like it? So go back to my pillars, financial strength. The balance sheet's gotten a lot stronger. As of their last quarter, they're 2.9 times debt to EBITDA. If you look at the income statement versus the debt, but remember, I don't think the assets as far as timberlands are marked to market. You know, if you look at what these assets and the acreage is worth and where they trade in the market, I think the timberland unit itself is probably worth more than the whole company. If you aggregate, especially the southern acreage and the Pacific Northwest acreage, which is about 10 million, that northwest, the northern acreage in Michigan and places like that isn't worth a lot of money, but that's only a million acres. They've really improved their balance sheet. This year, they'll pay down about $1 billion of debt. They've got $500 million scheduled to pay down in the fourth quarter. That should get them very close to that billion. They reinstituted a dividend that's sustainable just off of the timberland and real estate unit. And that is interesting, and I'll get to that if you think about the vision. Now they've established a dividend just off kind of one half of the company, the timberland and the real estate. It opens up a question of what is Wood Products, an operating company, doing within a timber REIT? And I'll come back to that. But again, if you think about vision and what this company can be, that's an important question, especially with a company tipping their hand, in my view, a little bit of how the dividend is going to be structured. So the balance sheet's strong. It's getting better. As far as ability to grow, the trees in the north grow about 7 to 10% a year. The trees in the south grow 7 to 10% a year. I'm going to try to jump forward on these slides here. Let me see if I can get to, and you can go through these slides. They're not mine. They're on the web. Talking about the housing market, you know, this is what I was referring to. 2005 and 2006, look at the housing starts, and we're still so far below where we've been. This debt has been worked off, but I think the movement that you've seen, millennials starting to buy houses, housing stock in the U.S. being older and repair and renovation picking up, you know, there's room to get back to 1.4, 1.5 million starts, which would really help timber prices in the volumes in this business. We don't actually need that where the valuation is because we've been flat for a while. So again, an acceleration, which I think will be there, will be icing on the cake. The second part of how this company can grow just beyond renovation and new housing starts is through its building products unit. And one thing to think about is cyclicals upside to inflation. Lumber was about $400 per 1,000 board feet coming into this year. In March, it fell to $300. You know, people panicked. Nobody bought anything. Look at the bottom right, that circle. $10 per metric board feet equals $45 million of EBITDA. Lumber today is $580. So that's $180 over where we began the year, $280 over the March low. The upside in EBITDA annually can be $675 to $750 million at current prices. It's amazing, especially if we think housing starts have been lower and can continue. You know, and look where you've been in the past, $500, $600 lumber might not be out of the question for a couple of years. And even though it might be a cyclical peak, that cash is going to hit the company and improve the balance sheet. The other thing about the building products unit is the company has taken out 15% of the costs. And I don't want to go back here since 2003. I'm going to drive you crazy finding the slides, but it's in here. So they've really fixed up the operating structure of this unit. In my mind, again, the unit can stand on its own. It's very profitable. And remember what Weyerhaeuser did with its housing unit. They merged it with a company called WCI Communities and spun it out in 2015. So if they spun out this building products unit, it would leave Weyerhaeuser a pure play timber REIT. REIT investors wouldn't be confused anymore about what an operating company is doing buried in a REIT. And that's one aspect. The second aspect is in an environment where environmental, social, and governance is very important, governance could be taken care of by spinning out the building products unit. Again, it's just a cleaner, pure play REIT and putting the building products unit potentially where a different investor class can embrace it. But the carbon capture of growing trees, it could be a huge asset for Weyerhaeuser. When you hear Amazon talk about wanting to be emission free and in their commercials having no sense of how they're going to get there, buying carbon credits is probably a way they're going to get there. And where else would you get them? By a company that sequesters carbon in trees. And even when you cut down the trees to make 2x4s and plywood and things like that, the carbon's still sequestered in the house. So taking a lot of time on this one, I think fair value is about 36 to 45, depending on what you want to put on acreage valuations, if you do a sum of the part, and moreover, depending on how aggressive you want to be on EBITDA coming out of the building products unit, how long you want to say, lumber can be at 580 versus 500 versus 450. But where we are today, kind of in the mid to high 20s, it's a nice return for what I would consider an A company. So again, strong balance sheet, strong assets that are worth more than the balance sheet shows, and a nice potential upside on that one. A differing view, and I'm going to switch over now. Hopefully I get this right, Graham. Let's see. Can you see the Regis, Graham? Are you there?
Didn't work. It does not look like we're getting anything.
Oh, here, hold on.
There we go.
Can you see? Okay. Regis Corporation is, I think, an interesting opportunity today. Small cap, $194 million market value. The company, it cuts hair. It's consolidating into four major brands and about 6,900 hair cutting outlets. If you think what's going on in Regis right now, it's a strong recurring revenue business. Everybody needs to get their hair cut. Everybody likes to look good. It's kind of an essential service. They brought in a new CEO. They had a great CEO, Hugh Sawyer, who came in and restructured the model and launched them to a fully franchised operation. So they sold their stores out to franchisees, becoming capital light, really improving the balance sheet. Now they have the guy they brought in who was responsible for reinvigorating Popeyes, introducing the Popeyes chicken sandwich. And, he knows how to run franchisees, and he's the right guy at the right time to pivot Regis to growth. I see a lot of neglect here. COVID has shut down the Regis operations this summer. They're coming back to life. But the income statement is kind of meaningless right now because the assets can earn a lot more than they earned in 2020. It's an essential service. And unlike past recessions, the financial crisis, you still got your hair cut. In the COVID crisis, you couldn't. It was a supply shock. Everybody wanted to get their hair cut except for me with my nice shiny bald head. And you couldn't. You had to do it at home, or your kids were walking around with long hair looking like rock stars. So, it's a recurring business. And if you think of the business, if we are going to get a little inflation going forward, you price a haircut as you get it. And if you paid $12 4 to 6 weeks ago and you pay $12.25 or $12.50 today, that's not a big deal. So kind of digging into just quickly the balance sheet here, if you look at a screen, there's lots of neglect. Let me go over to, and I don't want to spend too much time on Regis because I do want to leave time for questions, but there's a ton of warning signs. Oops, I got to share the screen. New share. Going to the Guru site, lots of debt, lots of warning signs. This is really interesting up here. The stock was high 20s earlier this year. And if you look on a longer term basis, 28, it's down to 6.5 after a nice pop over the last couple of days. But what the market misses is the debt on the balance sheet is due to, ASC putting leases back on the balance sheet. So there's about $800 million in leases for this company that'll pop up when you do a screen. That is a misnomer on the balance sheet because about 80% of those leases are responsible by the franchisees, and Regis itself is paid back the rent expect. And again, Regis will finish selling and be 100% purely franchised by June of 2021. So all of those leases will be third-party responsibility. But moreover, it's not debt. And if you were to even say it was their responsibility, you'd have to add back lease expense to your income. So just looking at screens on this one can really distract you. The way Regis says right now, they only have about $92 million of short-term lease liabilities on their balance sheet. And by the end of June 2021, with the fully franchised model, they hope it'll be zero. So the franchising going to a capital light, strong balance sheet, their net debt, except for the leases, is not that much. They had $85 million in cash, $178 million in debt. So pretty strong balance sheet otherwise. Don't look at the income statement today because they were shut for part of the year and they're opening back slowly with spacing and appointments, but, you know, kind of back to normal, maybe in a year, maybe in 18 months, clearly within our investment horizon. Think about vaccines. You know, this is a pretty strong vaccine play. I talked about recurring revenue. They've got a low market share, less than 10% of haircuts. A lot of their stores are in Walmarts, so, you know, easy, family-friendly place to get a haircut. And we don't know the damage from mom and pop's hair salons that may have gone out due to COVID. But once they get to a fully franchised model, they can start buying small chains, converting them to the Supercuts brand and grow. And, you know, this is getting into the second part, how to grow, so they can grow through acquisitions. And every franchisee has commitments to add stores and to grow. And again, the new CEO, Philip Athey, who came in from Popeyes, his number one goal is to improve profitability of the franchisees to make them want to open up new stores. So as this company finishes its restructuring and pivots to growth with a strong balance sheet that gets picked up as negative on any sort of screening service, there's a lot of neglect and, in my mind, a lot of opportunity in a steady revenue business model if we're not all locked down due to COVID. There's other things they can do, and I don't want to drag too much on here, but they're going to try to sell more product, more shampoo, and things like that as a tap sales when they move through their process. But, you know, I think my fair value on this is about 12, and I get there by just looking at franchise lease profitability. You can go back to 10Ks and see what that is. Even at that price target, I'm using EBITDA margins that are about 500 basis points below what management has said they can achieve. So I'm being conservative, maybe grading into how quickly they can achieve that, but I think there could be upside beyond, you know, even that profitability level over time. So, you know, again, I think if you kind of ignore the income statement for now, look at the strength of the assets, look at how they can grow, and look at the valuation, this is something that could fit. And then just one last quickie, they said as they finish transitioning to fully franchised, private equity is actively looking at buying up the last chunks of their stores. You know, when you say private equity is getting interesting, in the back of my mind, I think private equity might be looking at the whole company, and I wouldn't be surprised to see interest in this company at this level. You know, as Marty would say, this could be a takeaway if it was bought anywhere near this level, given the upside. But, you know, clearly, I see undervaluation here, and potentially others would too. So, I've rambled for about 40 minutes, a little bit longer than I thought. So I'll cut it over to Q&A and kind of hear your thoughts.
Definitely. So it looks like we do have a decent handful of questions here built up, and a little bit of appreciation as well for tossing over to Guru Focus and speaking the language of our guests. So starting off, the first question we have here, any thoughts on Biogen with a PE less than 8, solid balance sheet, some consistent growth over the last couple of years, and the price dropping following the setback with their new drug?
So I haven't done the work on Biogen again because I'm kind of focusing in the smaller cap space. I've looked at it in the past. I have known Amgen as a value investor. I think what you need to do when you look at these companies, small cap biotechs are very hard given their cash flow negativity and kind of the binary nature of their revenues. But when you accumulate lots of drugs into something like a Biogen, the time I've found to buy them is when you can add up their existing pipeline, their existing franchise of drugs, what they're selling today, and their current cash flow, and buy that at a reasonable valuation and get the pipeline for free. So that's been a time to buy them because these things will always introduce and always buy. So that, you know, that's how I can answer it. That's how I would approach it. If you think the disappointment is written off their entire pipeline when it was just one drug, that does happen. I'm not saying it's happening here, but that's how I would approach that analysis.
Understood. And when you're looking at a company, do you have a set margin of safety or does it kind of change per company?
Well, a set margin of safety, I do look at upside and downside as well. I don't like to take more than 10 to 15% downside risk. Now that does vary on A, B, C, or D. I think if you look at a cyclical and you get 50% up over 3 years, you're going to have a little bit more downside. And again, that's why I keep the position size smaller. If you're looking at a utility, likely you have less upside and less downside. So the quick answer is 10 to 15%. And that's a level where it's not where I would blow it out. It's where I would have conviction to buy more. Like that's what I think of a downside is, where would you double the position? And you know, over my career, sometimes going down 15%, doubling the position has ended up to be some of my best stocks down the road.
I see. And good lead in with this question for the page we have up here currently on the screen. How do you recognize a value trap? What makes you, I guess, what convinces you that something truly is a value trap?
Well, again, I think I'm going to switch off that page. look, a value trap is something that can't grow. And whether you're trying to buy a cigar butt or a cigarette price or buy a melting ice cube for less than it's worth, your enemy when you try to do that is time. You know it's going to end badly. And what you're trying to say is maybe the assets can produce cash flow in a curve that's a little bit better than the curve of decline others are looking at. And I remember when MCI Communications came out as a public company, they were going to pay a 25% dividend for 3 years, even though long distance was in decline. I don't, you know, have to correct me because this was years ago, but I think they paid that dividend one quarter and bankruptcy wasn't far behind because we all knew it was going to go bad. And you were trying to game what the melting asset was worth. So, you know, if you think of an asset, if it's not growing and it's not producing return on invested capital that's positive, or meaning returns that are over its cost of capital, meaning the assets are still productive, you know, I worry about that. And, you know, I can think about things like if, you know, oil and gas under pressure and the advent of shale oil, as much as people don't like shale oil, I think it's really impaired the whole concept of offshore oil. Why would you put a 10-year investment in the Gulf of Mexico for billions of dollars when you can click on and off a shale well with as good, if not better, economics? You know, so that whole industry, rigs, supply boats, you know, to me, just it's assets that may be mismarked on the balance sheet. And again, if it's hard to see that industry accelerating and gaining share, you know, unless we have massive banning of onshore production, which kind of looks like we're not going to get if you believe some of the statements.
Definitely. And on the note of those oil companies and producers and whatnot, do you have any views on midstream and pipeline companies, examples that we have here in the questionnaire, ET, EPD, ENB?
Yeah. So, you know, I was at Sloat Weissman back in the mid 90s where, you know, that's when all those came out. I actually own shares of Enron Natural, ENP, and Enron Partners before it was bought by Rich Kinder and became Kinder Morgan Partners, which really turned into Kinder Morgan. So those are fun when they first start out, and the splits are, you know, 2% to the company and 98% to investors, and you can pile up assets and grow a dividend that's a return on capital dividend. But what's happened now is you're up into the 50-50 splits, and that's raised the cost of capital into an industry that potentially is not going to see a lot of growth in pipelines. You know, even if production plateaus for a number of years, it's not clear to me that we're going to need a lot more assets. You might need an asset in Texas or North Dakota, but, you know, in general, you're not going to need a lot more. So I think the heyday of growth for those assets are past. I don't own any of those. And I'd also be careful about which type of asset you want in there. I think the ones that were real midstream gathering or real upstream, just production related or price related, avoid those. If you can find ones that you can get a 20-year asset and take advantage of the depreciation and get a nice return on capital dividend, you know, the dividends there are pretty high these days. So, you know, maybe there's something to do there. Again, I'm not involved, but I that's kind of my thoughts on the industry. I've been there, but not really involved today.
Gotcha. And do you have any thoughts on gold mining companies? One that comes up a lot for us in these presentations is Kirkland Lake Gold.
I don't have a thought on Kirkland Lake Gold. Given my view that the debt and the economy growth is going to, and the Fed wants inflation, I think we're going to get some inflation. I'm not talking about 15% inflation or 10% inflation, but, you know, we've been under 2, under 1, or close to 0 for a long time. So getting back to 2 or 3 or 4 over the next couple of years, especially when the Fed says it wants that and it's going to let it run hot. I mean, people say don't fight the Fed. Well, when they're out saying they want inflation, I think people need to at least start talking about it and thinking about it. So, you know, I think gold is an asset class, could work in the portfolios of some people. Physical gold is hard. You have to store it. The gold ETFs have problems in enrolling it. And when you start to get company specific, you get into mine quality and reserve life and locations of those mines globally. So not a lot of great answers on how to do it, you know, company by company, or the gold ETF has typically been how I've approached it in the past. Again, just focusing on low debt, as low capital intensity as possible, and reserves that are kind of proved but undeveloped. People hate those in the oil industry, but it just means they're there and you'll get to them over time. To me, that's a risk that's a little easier to take than trying to say, we hope we can find something.
Gotcha. And how long do you protect yourself if your investment goes against you? For example, putting out a stop loss or buying more into a company?
It depends on why. And it goes back to that sell discipline. A lot of things in my portfolio right now have caused my hair to fall out because, in my mind, people don't understand what they are and the power of them and what they're worth. If my investment case is valid and the reason I bought it are still there, the balance sheet is strong, meaning I'm not in need of cash. I have positive cash flow or enough cash versus debt with no maturities, and the capital stack is healthy, and I'm not in need of equity, not in need of massive investment that has to be financed. And the competitive advantage and the whole reason I bought the company still makes sense. More often than not, I feel tempted to buy down. And some, you know, there's position size limits that I've talked about and how I think about that. But that's more important to me than if something happens with a company, it goes down and they need more capital, they have to raise equity, or that 2022 January maturity for half of the capital stack starts looming and it looks like they might have to put out some equity versus just refinancing it, or there's a competitive product offering, or the profitability that they said was going to be in this industry just isn't there. If you're a construction company and you're having trouble on an asset, you fall behind on contract accounting, you know, all those things would lead me to sell it because those would be broken cases. But if the investment case is still there and the balance sheet is there, I'll give it time because, look, it matters when it matters. And that's an important point for investing. And who would have thought Monday, we had this huge rip. If you look back and say, were you surprised by it? Yeah, I was surprised by it on the day. I wasn't surprised that it happened. And I think it continued to happen because these things are undervalued. The whole space is undervalued. Value itself is a value versus growth. Growth is extended and value is hated and undervalued in my mind. So a rotation to the space can happen. So just because it's been down doesn't necessarily make a sell. It really has to be broken. I have to have a better idea on the downside. Those are kind of the two reasons to sell.
Definitely. And you mentioned they're losing some hair, or we'll call it sleep, over some maybe misrepresentations or misunderstood value. What initially led you into Regis, and despite all of these kind of, you know, red flags that other people are seeing?
So I've been aware of Regis since 2013. And I've hated, I haven't owned the company. I haven't recommended the company. I haven't liked it. This is a recent purchase for me within the last 60 to 90 days. They didn't know what to do with themselves. They wanted to train their stylists and become upscale. Then they had too many brands and they wanted an acquisition binge. And that's why they had to bring in Hugh Sawyer from Huron Consulting to basically coalesce the brands, make it a consolidated company, and really come up with a strategy to franchise and improve the profitability of each franchise unit. And he did some, good lifting on that and got the process 80% done as of today, or as of the last quarter. Now you have the new CEO, Mr. Athied, and I'm butchering his name. I just can't say it, who came over from Popeyes, really experienced with the franchise model, keeping franchisees profitable and looking to grow them. The strategy makes sense to me now. The balance sheet makes sense to me now. The COVID crisis gave me the opportunity. I mean, COVID drove the stock price down to where I see decent upside. I mean, if everything was the same and COVID hadn't happened and this was hanging out in the high teens, I probably would not be involved because, it's all three parts. It's, are the assets worth more than you think? Can they grow? And is the valuation opportunity there? So, you do this for a while, you watch a lot of companies, and sometimes the opportunities present themselves. So hopefully that helps.
Understood. And do you see, or I guess, when would you say you should consider asset value over book value, or would you always consider it over book value?
Well, they're one in the same. Right. I mean, I consider asset value and what book value should be. So book value is tough because, in a company, I've got a company that I own, an insurance company, Lincoln National, that's bought back 100 million shares out of 300 over the past few years. That's destroying book value, but it's really not. If you think about retained earnings. So I compare book value to retained earnings. In a company like Weyerhaeuser or some of the part bases or a real estate company, you really have to look at what the assets are worth versus what they're marked on the balance sheet, because over time, real estate appreciates and you don't always capture that through the balance sheet. You have to be careful of goodwill or intangibles on the balance sheet. A lot of times, companies will look like they don't have a lot of earnings, but on a cash earnings basis, they do, because the goodwill from an acquisition has been pushed down. So you do need to look at it, but you do need to do it independently, and you have to make sure it makes sense. When you look at the asset value and you look at retained earnings and you look at book value, it all has to make sense and hang together. And, you know, you just have to get through the 10Ks and the 10Qs and the history of the company to understand what's been going on. But to me, what the company can earn off of that investment, you know, is the most important thing. You know, can they earn? What do they have to do to earn? How long will it take? And how long can that window last? You know, you're looking for the combination of that.
Definitely. And we'll go ahead and jump into our last one here. Got a couple of people asking, do you have any thoughts on Intel, which shows a strong balance sheet and good margins, but market valuing at low multiples?
Again, it's a larger cap and it's a little out of my purvey. Look, I think we're on the cusp of exciting revolution in 5G and artificial intelligence. You know, banks are using artificial intelligence to, you know, catch errors in applications and processing and, you know, all sorts of, you know, bots and things running through. And 5G will kind of revolutionize phones and the Internet of Things. So, you know, we're going to need chips. I'm not into the weeds on Intel. I know Apple's trying to insource a lot of their own chips. I don't know how Intel is combating that, how pervasive that is, or, you know, what Intel's got up its sleeves. But again, I'd look at their assets and their install base, you know, losing share at Apple. What does that mean versus, you know, other makers globally, you know, HP, Lenovo, and everybody else like that. So again, it's a framework, but I don't have the specific questions for, you know, their current market share. If it turns out that they haven't invested in their technology and they're really falling behind, it could turn into an IBM or a digital equipment corporation or something like that, you know, just tech that gets old and can't get out of its own way. I'm not saying it is. They might revolutionize themselves and jump forward a generation and be competitive again, which they have done in the past. But that's the type of thinking I would look at versus just what's the price and what's the balance sheet for that one.
Definitely. Well, I'd like to say thank you, Chip, for joining us today and answering all these questions and giving us such a great presentation. I know it's very appreciated from our audience, and we love to have people coming out with differing views to bring a unique perspective to value investing.
All right, Graham, thanks a lot. Thanks for the opportunity, guys. I hope you found it helpful.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.